Welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on March 15th, 2015, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
Good afternoon. Our special guest, Paul Cremo, is the dramaturge and director of the Opera Commissioning Program at the Metropolitan Opera, overseeing the Met and Lincoln Center Theaters New Works Program for New Opera and Music Theater Development. He's also supervised the development of English language versions of The Magic Flute, The Barber of Seville, Die Fledermaus, and The Merry Widow. And he's also worked in the field for Sony Classical, Sony Masterworks, Sony Classical Films, and for Spring Creek Productions at Warner Brothers. And he's on the nominating panel for the Tony Awards. And I believe there are just two more performances this season of the Met's production of Tales of Hoffman, Les Contes de Hoffman. I think they're this week. Paul, you'll correct me if I'm wrong. Please welcome Paul Cremo.
You want the podium?
Sure, man. Thank you. Thanks a lot. Thank you. It's nice to be here today. Jacques Offenbach's Le Comte d'Offman is considered one of the greatest operas in the repertory, and some consider it even the greatest French opera. But interestingly, it was Offenbach's only major opera, and it was his last. He died before he could finish composing it. But Offenbach was no neophyte. He had achieved fame and great success over the previous 25 years before his death with a series of extremely popular comic operettas called opera bouffes, which he was almost single-handedly created. They were known for combining entrancingly light music, fantastical plots, witty, topical, satirical comedy, dance, dialogue, and song. One of the most famous of these was Orpheus in the Underworld, which gave us the famous can-can music, which we all know. These operettas made Offenbach the toast of Paris, but he wanted more. Offenbach was an outsider of sorts, a German-born Jew, the son of a cantor, who had changed his name and come to the City of Light as a teenager. But after years of operetta fame, he craved acceptance as a serious artist. He wanted his legacy to be defined by a more substantial, sophisticated work, a true masterpiece, an opera. He took as his subject three stories by the fantasy writer E.T.A. Hoffmann, whose novella was the basis for the ballet The Nutcracker, which we all know. Offenbach's librettist Jules Barbier adapted a play he had written with Michel Carré, which told the story of Hoffmann, the poet, and his three loves: Olympia, a young girl, a courtesan, Giulietta, and a doomed artist, a singer, Antonia. The conceit of the libretto was that all of these three loves of Hoffmann's life were the embodiment of one woman, his latest love, the prima donna Stella. Despite his passionate love for all of these women, the character of Hoffmann never seems to be able to achieve his dream. His desire is elusive. Hoffmann was, in a way, Offenbach's alter ego. He sought something that he could never quite capture in his lifetime, something beyond the fame earned by his lightly entertaining works. And as his health declined dramatically as he composed Hoffmann, he knew that it would be his final, and he hoped finest, artistic statement. Unfortunately, Offenbach died at the age of 61, 4 months before the premiere of Hoffmann, and it was left to Ernest Guiraud to complete the work and to finish the orchestrations that Offenbach had only started. Guiraud also replaced the dialogue that was in the original work with what's called recitatives, which is a musicalized form of dialogue that propels the plot in between musical numbers and arias. Guiraud was also well known for having done a similar thing for Bizet's Carmen. Bizet died, and after his death, Guiraud composed, sung recitatives, replacing the dialogue in that opera. Guiraud also made several other changes. He, some were at the insistence of the theater owner that was presenting the work. Some were to accommodate particular cast members. For instance, the character of Niklaus was cut down dramatically because of the limitations of that singer. Most significantly, though, he cut the Venetian act featuring the character of Giulietta entirely, and ended the work with the story of Hoffmann's doomed love, Antonia. The one thing that he kept from the Venetian act was the famous Barcarolle, which is the hit tune of the opera. And in order to accommodate that, they set the act with Giulietta, with Antonia in Venice. The premiere of the piece took place in 1881 at the Opéra Comique in Paris and was a great success. It was followed in the following year by productions in New York and Vienna and many international cities. But the work, as performed, was far from Offenbach's original vision. Ever since that production, opera companies, lacking a definitive performing score, have taken license to assemble different versions, cutting and adding and changing the music as well as the order and content of scenes. Up until the late 1980s, most versions have ordered the opera to give us the stories of Olympia, Giulietta, and Antonia in that order. In recent decades, as musical scholarship has stressed authenticity and the original intentions of the composer more, and as more material has surfaced, some of Offenbach's original notes and sketches, and even a censor's score that had been submitted to the Paris censor, music scholars began to get a more clear picture of what was originally intended, and versions of the score had been created to reflect this. It's now become more common to place the Antonia act in the middle and end the story in dissolute Venice with the character of Giulietta. This was according to the original wishes of Offenbach and his librettist. And this is the version that's currently being used at the Met in our production. It was assembled 20 or so years ago by Maestro James Levine, who's our music director, as this scholarship began to come forward, and was somewhat controversial because it had gone against years of performance practice, but has now become more accepted to do it in that order. And with the current production, which premiered in 2010, directed by Tony winner Bartlett Scheer, this is the version of the score that is used. As Bruce said, there's two more performances, March 18th and 21st, so please come and try to compare the versions, the operatic version and the film version. The Tales of Hoffmann, with its dreamlike structure and wide-ranging fantastical narrative and supernatural imagery, is a natural for film. And as you see, Powell and Pressburger pull out all the stops in their integration of the surreal imagery with their production design, vivid colors, Frederick Ashton's choreography, and a variety of acting and singing styles. The film uses the story sequence more common at the time that the film was made in 1951, but it also makes substantial musical cuts. So I think if you come to the Met, you'll see quite a bit of difference between the two versions of the work. It's interesting to note that the film's conductor, Sir Thomas Beecham, conducted the London premiere of Hoffmann in 1910. Hoffmann has existed in many forms over the years, and the 1951 film version presents yet another version. But regardless of the changes, the brilliance of Offenbach's score shines through, and the wildly imaginative story is brought to vivid cinematic life in Paul and Pressburger's film. I hope you enjoy it, and I hope you'll come to the Met to compare. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcasts. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.